Okay, let's go ahead and call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Jim C. Martini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Mandeep Dillon. Mike Lynch. Darren Garrett.
Here.
Gordon Ford. Donna Riley. Joan Clendenin. We have a quorum.
Okay. Item number three, are there any announcements? Hearing and seeing none, we'll move on to item four, public comment. Not seeing anyone from the public here, I'll dispense with the public comment item. Moving on to item five, consent items. Give everyone a moment to review the consent items as listed.
I'll move approval of consent items.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to approve the consent items as listed on the agenda. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Moving on now to item six, Investment Manager Annual Presentation 6A, Greenfield Partners LLC.
I was thinking on getting them on the phone.
Okay.
I know for the minutes that just no one will join the group.
The traffic's terrible out there, and the roads are closed off, it's hard to get here. So you're going to behavioral health?
Yes, I started there about 6 days ago.
I started in the weekly bulletin we get.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I hope that works out real well for you.
I think it will.
So it's just audio, no visual?
Need some work, but it'll be okay.
Graham's going to do it on video. Is there anybody there?
Dean Sonner from Greenfield Partners is here.
Hi, Dean. This is Rick Santos, director here at Stansera. You have the board's ear.
Oh, terrific. Hi, Rick. Hello.
Hi.
Everybody else? I appreciate your time today. I understand from Kelly you'd like me to speak for roughly about 20 minutes or so. Rick, is that?
Yeah, and then leave just a few minutes for questions, Dean.
Okay, very good. And I know it's difficult not being face-to-face, but please, as always, if anybody wants to interrupt me with any questions along the way, if something's not clear, I'm more than happy to field the questions as we go along. So you have the presentation in front of you, and the pages are numbered, so I'll just refer to the page numbers as I go through. Some of these pages will be familiar to you from approximately a year ago. So I'll only touch on the points in those pages where I think an update is warranted. If you look at page three in terms of the company overview, I'm just going to give you a few key points here on these next few pages and we'll move on quickly. We have 48 people now in four offices. Westport's our headquarters. I'm speaking to you from Chicago, where I've officed for the last 17 years. We now have an office in Austin, Texas, and we continue to have an office in Arlington, Virginia. In terms of our funds, we are currently in the process of raising Fund 8. We actually had an initial closing around 30 days ago for that fund, and we're not going to be focused on that today, but obviously more talking about Fund 7, Greenfield Acquisition Partners 7, or GAP 7 as we call it for short. which is the investment that you all are in. Moving on to page four, the organizational chart, I just wanted to point out a couple of things here that I think are relevant. I think it's always important to talk about the personnel at the firm. The seven of us that own the firm are shown in the gray boxes at the top, and you can see in each one of the boxes there's a number in parentheses, and that represents the number of years that the individual has been with the company. So you can see that our principals have been with the firm an average of 17 years, so no change there from last year, then obviously increasing by a year. However, there have been some changes in roles with those folks, starting with the gray box to the right, Paul Altieri, who has been our CFO since the founding of the firm. Paul is now taking a step back and focusing on some of our own general partner kind of issues, et cetera. We'll call it semi-retirement, although if he were on the phone, he would tell you he's working as hard as he ever has. I have stepped from my COO position into the CFO role with my background as a CPA. It seemed to make the most sense for me to move into that role. Dan Nix, who has for the last 9 years headed up our asset management responsibilities, he is now COO. And then lastly, Raj Menon, who has been really functioning very much in this co-CIO role for the last several years, now has that as his title, but continues to work on our debt, which is how we got introduced to Raj in the first place, 14 years ago since he joined us. And then the balance of the folks in the green boxes are people who don't own the firm, but they do put up their own capital, and they are investing in the funds alongside you. I won't really spend any significant time on page five, simply because those are, I think, words that come off the page. But I do think that relative to when we first all met, it is certainly, we think, still a good time to invest in real estate. However, I would tell you that it is more difficult than when we first met a few years back in terms of finding these asymmetries that exist out there. They were more plentiful back in 2010 and 2011 when there was a lot of dislocation in the world. But that notwithstanding, we would tell you that there is a significant bias in the marketplace towards the major markets, and we've continued to focus on secondary central business districts as well as some suburban office market. We just don't see the competition in those markets that we do in the major markets. So we're continuing to look across all the various property types, and then we'll get more specific as we go into this the balance of the presentation. On page six, I always think it's instructive when you're looking at a firm like ours that invests in all property types. We've invested in nearly every property type since inception. This is sort of a snapshot of what we've done since inception, and I think this page is instructive to not only have you understand the breadth of the things that we've done over the years, but also the things we're not doing currently, things that we don't find attractive for various reasons currently, but also where our portfolio stands today. So if you start at on the left-hand side where we show the portfolio since inception, there are seven bullet points there, and the bottom three really represent three product types that we are not involved in currently. We have done five student housing projects. We've sold out of the last of those. One of those was in fund five, gap five. The other four were development transactions we did in fund six, and those have all been disposed of. Similarly, about 6.5 million square feet of on-airport air cargo facilities. We continue to like that category, but we have not been able to find assets that meet our criteria for total return. And then finally, assisted living facilities. This is an area where we will continue to look, but we have not been successful in the last several years being able to find a transaction that made sense. When you look at what we currently own, we only own four hotels today, which is a significant decrease from what we've owned over the years. We've owned 41 hotels. three of those four hotels that we own today are in Fund 7, the fund that you all have invested in. The largest one is actually under contract from a much earlier fund. It represents the vast majority of the total keys that we mentioned here. Simply put, we continue to be concerned about the large branded hotels. We used to love them. We did very well with them over the years. But the issue today for us is that that market has become extremely efficient due to the internet, various apps that allow people to get very efficient pricing, particularly for those folks that are trying to book a room kind of at the last minute. They used to be the people that we would make a very high margin off of. Simply put, they are now people we make a very low margin off of. So although we've done some hotels, it's a relatively small percentage of the overall capital, and we'll touch on that in a moment. Really where our focus has been, continues to be on office, which again, don't think of that as large city, central suburban, or central business district, pardon me, but more secondary markets and to a lesser extent, suburban office as we go forward. The other part of the focus has been industrial. So today our portfolio is primarily in those two categories, and we're gonna be talking about those in a little bit more detail. We only have two multifamily projects currently. Multifamily, i.e. apartments, have been the darling as home ownership rates have continued to drop. We continue to be concerned about the added new supply in many markets. We also are concerned about the amount of money that people are willing to pay on a per unit basis. So we are only active right now in two projects, whereas you know, since inception we've done 32 projects. And then lastly, we have some loan portfolios and some land holdings. So let's move on to the next two pages. And I apologize. You get an idea of my PowerPoint skills. Somehow I duplicated certain things in the next couple of pages, and so there is some redundancy. But let's just start on page 7. We had our final closing in Gap 7, which you participated in. Our final closing was in June of 2015. You all committed $15 million. And we've called 2/3 of that. And towards the end of the presentation here, I'll sort of take you through a slide that I actually had prepared originally for Veris, but I think it's also instructive for what we're doing today to give you an idea. If we, you know, to answer the simple question, if you've only called 67% of the capital, why are you all coming out with Fund 8? I think the slide towards the end of the presentation will illuminate that a little bit. We've made 24 investments. They represent peak equity of $390 million, so it's a little bit in excess of what the fund's committed capital is, but that's because we've already realized on some investments and therefore we'll do some recycling of the capital. Two assets you can see listed there, 121 West Trade and South Park Office Center. We've done a full round trip on, very pleased with the IRR as well as the overall multiple. And then we have two portfolios in this fund, which tends to make it confusing for people to understand some of what we've done here. What you can see thus far with the gross IRR and the multiples are on that. So if you would turn to page 8, and I'll ignore the top part because again, it is somewhat redundant, except I need to point out that on GMSIP, which is in right in the middle of the page, that bullet point is accurate where we say 24 assets sold and 2 pending. There was a typo on the prior page. So we sold a total of, 24 plus the 2 that are pending, 26 assets for $4,500 IRR and a 1.6 multiple. And that's the portfolio that we closed on a little over a couple years ago now. But you can see that the composition of the portfolio is really right on top of what I explained to you are our targets we're going to be, specifically as it relates to office and industrial. I think it's important at this point in time in the presentation to remind you that when we last were together, I had mentioned that office for us was sort of the value strategy. So we don't expect significant growth in rents. We don't expect a significant amount of appreciation above what our all-in basis is in these assets. We intend in the office part of this portfolio to make the vast majority of our total return from current cash flow. In contrast, industrial is really the growth strategy. I mentioned when I first met all of you that we were seeing a resurgence in industrial demand in the United States, and although in order to get the kinds of returns we're looking for, we can't compete by owning, you know, the Amazon fulfillment centers and some of the, you know, new prototypical type distribution centers, but we can do very well in what we sort of refer to as the last mile type of strategy, where you're buying infill locations here in Chicago near O'Hare Airport or near the Ford plant on the south side. We have continued to see, and we'll talk a little bit more specifics, we've continued to see significant growth. And then to a lesser extent, we've done some multifamily for you, some debt investments, and some hospitality. Because last two times, I presented to you all, we spoke a lot about office. I thought in creating this presentation, it would make more sense for us to not speak as much about office this time and focus on a couple of areas that I think would be of more interest to you, and that namely on office and debt. So that's really where I'm going to spend the vast majority of the balance of my comments. On page 9, I simply there gave you a listing, and this is a little bit for both Rick and Barris as well. I gave you a listing of all the properties that we have in the portfolio, broken out by a few different categories. The top section are the assets that we reviewed at the annual meeting. So if you want more detail on all of those assets, you can access on the website, our website, you can access the annual meeting presentation. There are a couple of transactions in the middle of the page, which are the assets that we sold. And then there are a handful of assets that we did not cover. Typically for our annual meetings, we try to cover at least two-thirds of the value of the assets in the portfolio. I think in this instance, we had a significantly higher percentage that we were able to cover. So I just pointed you to some additional materials if anybody wanted to delve in any further. The next several pages are just to give you an idea. The next three, just a geographical dispersion of the assets that we own. It was a little too busy to try to put all on one map. That's the only reason we divided it up the way we did. However, just to fill you in on some of our abbreviations, on page 10, that's just a listing, really, of all of the assets that are not part of these various portfolios that we acquired. Page 11 are the remaining assets that we have in what we call GMSP. That's just Greenfield Multi-State Portfolio. Those are office assets. And then finally on page 12, GMSIP, which is Greenfield Multi-State Industrial Portfolio. And those are all of our industrial assets throughout the country. So let's dive in briefly here. I've got, looks like about another 5-7 minutes or so. On industrial, we acquired a 9.3 million square foot portfolio really in two different transactions, and that represents a significant portion of the overall industrial that you have in the portfolio. We bought these for below replacement costs. We think our basis here is about 70% of what it would cost to replace those assets. We are currently 93% occupied. And importantly, we had forecast that we were going to own this through the middle of 2019 when we originally acquired these portfolios, and these bullet points are underneath the investment plan / status off to the right. We forecast owning this through mid-19. We had assumed that our average occupancy throughout the whole was 88%. So you can see that here that there's a significant strength in occupancy versus what we had originally underwritten. And importantly, if you recall, I had mentioned that industrial for us was our growth strategy. Our 2016 NOI is projected to go up by 14% when we hit 2018. And that's a significant growth. You know, you typically don't think of rental growth as being that significant over a two-year period. So again, I hope it speaks to you, to the strength that we now see in the industrial market. It is a market. There are numerous statistics up here. It is a market where we have seen 25 quarters of positive absorption. Almost all of the markets that are generally tracked by our research, we have 58 of them, 53 of those 58 have experienced positive rent growth. So it's one of those areas where you see growth, you see pricing power in the hands of the landlord, and we like to see that. Particularly if our basis is below replacement cost, it means we can be very competitive on rents and yet enjoy growth in occupancy and rents. Going on to page 14, I won't spend much time on this, but the North Austin portfolio, this is a much higher growth market. This is focused on a single market. It's the fastest growing metropolitan area. In the U.S., the industrial rent growth here has been significant, 30% growth in rent over the last 5 years. Very low vacancy. Again, here we purchased for what we believe to be about 70% of replacement cost. So very high expected rates of return now on these assets. And we'll be looking over the course of the next year to continue to trim back both of these portfolios. So hopefully you get the sense in the industrial market. Again, I spent the vast majority of my time last time talking about office, and today I want to talk about industrial, but I also thought it was instructive to talk about debt. Debt in our business, we typically, as you recall, we typically only utilize about 50 to 60, 65% leverage, but you can't ignore the debt markets, and in fact, today, we think that there's some opportunity for us to invest in debt. We have historically invested in debt from time to time, whether it's something as complex as Fund 5. We purchased B pieces from commercial mortgage-backed securities, so those are the more junior, they're not the most senior tranches, did very well in that arena. We have done a significant amount of mezzanine lending over time, and we're really looking now at what I'll call two different platforms to invest in debt. But let's set the stage just briefly. CMBS, commercial mortgage-backed securities, if you look at the chart on the left, I'm now on page 15, you can see that both CMBS maturities are peaking in 2017, so that's sort of that rust-colored bar at the bottom of the stack bar in 2017. But also overall commercial real estate loan maturities are peaking in 2017. So from this point forward, you're gonna have less in the way of annual maturities than you have in the last several years. So when we look at the composition of it though, this is where the real change has occurred. Commercial mortgage-backed securities through the first half of the year only represent 9%. Of the lending. That is in contrast with 54% pre-crisis, but even so significantly less than the 21% 2015. And even more specifically, the third bullet point there, you started to see a significant drop in capital really being available for the under $10 million range. The CMBS lenders have tended to focus on larger loans. So we're really focused on, in one part of this program, on making some loans with good sponsorship, but in the smaller loan size. If you're somebody looking for somewhere in that 1 to 10, or even I would argue up to $15 million loan size, you don't have a tremendous number of options available to you. And so we think that there is some opportunity there. So if you go to page 16, there are a lot of charts here and a lot of numbers, but I want to try to do this, and it's difficult over the phone. But let me try to focus us in on a couple things here. On page 16, on the right, those bar charts called lender composition, in conjunction here with that first bullet point, the banks. have really benefited from this drop in the CMBS volume that I mentioned. Banks today are now representing about 40% of the lending in our commercial real estate space. But small banks are the ones that have really pulled back. Okay? So that takes us to the last page of this on page 17, the last page of the debt. And I'm not going to take you through, in the interest of time, I'm not going to take you through, but I would urge you to read each one of those, the first four columns. But I want to focus you on what we think the opportunity is, which is the column off to the right on page 17. We think the opportunity that the dislocation in those other markets is affording us is to do small to medium loans where we can close quickly. We are lending on transitional assets, and you have to think of transitional assets as really kind of the value add to opportunistic assets. So that's the value add, that's the space that we play in with our equity every day. So we're very comfortable with dealing with the transitional assets. We don't think we will get recourse debt. These are typically smaller operators where we have to underwrite the real estate itself properly. We're still looking to not exceed a 75% LTV, even if we're lending high octane / high interest rate debt. And we are looking to get a minimum multiple. And with the time I have remaining, I just want to focus on just one more, if I could, one more transaction. I want to move off this very quickly. On page 18, this is a transitional asset. This will be a redevelopment. We funded $14.5 million of a total $17 million. We are back there by $20 million of cash from the borrower, 18 of which was funded at closing. So the borrower has almost the same amount that we have in the transaction day one. And most importantly, the borrower, or I shouldn't say most importantly, but equally importantly, the borrower is a joint venture among four significant DC developers. So we are getting a very high rate of return, half of which will be paid currently, half of which will be accrued. And we're going to, it's an 18-month term, but they have to give us a minimum multiple of 1.35. So the IRR here, we believe, is very acceptable given the risk, but we build in a minimum multiple because we don't want to put our money out and not have it be a multiple that is acceptable. Importantly, the money that goes into these types of transactions early on in a fund, we will typically try to turn that money one more time so that the overall multiple on that money is closer to a 1.7, 1.8. Well, the next two pages are just a map and a graphic so you can see what the project will look like at the end. And then lastly, as it relates to the debt that we actually have, that we are borrowers in the fund, I always like to show a slide that gives you a sense as to any impending maturities. Really none in 2017. I'm on page 21 now. None in 2017. Most of our maturities are expected to occur in 2019, about 73% of the outstanding principal balance at our share, we expect to occur in 2019. And most of this debt in Gap 7, we floated. So 83% is floating. We've hedged at the asset level, so that for us that almost always means we've purchased a cap to cap our exposure. But importantly, we have traditionally been a floating rate borrower, and the reason we do that is we don't want to have to pay breakage costs when we decide to sell an asset. Simply put, we don't want the debt driving when we're able to sell an asset or when it's economically feasible to sell an asset. So we enjoy the flexibility here with 83% of the debt being floating. And that brings me to the very last page of the presentation, page 22. And this is what I alluded to early on. This is as of September 30th, so things have moved a little bit since then. We like to do things in quarter end, so they tie into capital statements, et cetera. We've drawn 67% of your capital, if you start on the right and then go clockwise. We also had a line balance of 6% of the committed capital. We reserve future asset management fees. We always have a general reserve of about 5% We have here a significant amount of reserve for investments that have already closed. We do have some development transactions in here that represent the majority of that amount. So that's equity that we will bleed into the investments as they are completed. And then finally, we have about 5% remaining capacity. I've been doing this for a long time here at Greenfield. You can expect that we will draw somewhere between 95 to 100% of your capital over time. And as I said, to date, or at least through 9/30, we've drawn 67%. So those are the remarks that I wanted to make today. Again, I wanted to just focus you on what you've owned with us, what we've sold, the areas that we like today and why. Again, think of industrial as our growth strategy. Think of office as more of the value strategy. But we are increasingly finding opportunities in the debt space. We're, I think for our next fund, you know, we think 15 to 20% of that fund could be investments in these types of debt opportunities. And furthermore, we think that those debt opportunities could be, depending on what happens with regulations and capital retention rules, et cetera, could be a very sustainable investment for us. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to highlight it today, even though it's a relatively small part of the portfolio today.
All right.
I'm looking at my clock. I know I've already hit my half hour or so.
Any questions for Dean?
How much longer is it going to be before you draw down all of the capital? You're talking about 6 months or a year, or have any timeline?
I think about 6 months. It's actually it's always an ongoing analysis. I think to be safe, it's probably 6 to 9 months. That's primarily going to be governed by how quickly the capital is needed at a couple of the multifamily projects that we're doing in the fund. It's also the reserves that I have in there are also for leasing, tenant improvement leasing commissions on both the office and industrial. So a little bit is going to depend on what the underlying activity is, but I think 6 to 9 months is a safe bet. I think you'll probably see us crest 80% of the capital calls here within the first half of the year, and then approaching that 95% most certainly by a year from now, but I would think by the end of the third quarter.
So I have a question. When you say debt investments, are there risk associated with it, like a risk of default on those investments?
Yes. So think of it this way. When a lender would traditionally make a loan, and they would make the loan for, say, 75% loan to value, and then the equity would represent that last 25%, the riskiest piece. The opportunity that we see out there now is to let the first mortgage lender loan, say, up to 60%, and we would take the loan from, say, 60% to 75%, but then the equity would still have the riskiest piece, the last 25. So, absolutely, whenever you lend money, whenever you invest money, you're going to take some risk. But we think that if you are not overly aggressive, stay sort of within that 75% less exposure, pick good borrowers/sponsors. So we'll do a background check on each and every one of these groups that we would do a venture with or lend to a venture. And then finally, really understand the risk you're getting in associated with the real estate, and making sure that if you're going to take the risk of default, that you not only have the wherewithal from a liquidity standpoint to be able to fix the problem if you were to need to do that down the road, but you also have the ability, the technical ability, to be able to work your way out of the problem. So if we lend on a multifamily transaction, for instance, if we start to sense that there is going to be an issue, with it down the road, I will start reserving cash, and we obviously have the expertise to execute on. So yeah, you're always, these things are never risk-free, but we feel very good about the risk-reward relationship, if you will, that we have in the assets that we've lent money on to date.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right, Dean, looks like we're good.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thanks very much, everybody. If there are any other questions subsequently, however you'd like to follow them through would be just fine, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving to all of you.
You too. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll move on to item 6B, the Investment Manager Annual Presentation for White Oak Global Advisors, LLC.
Rick here.
Hey Rick, how are you?
I'm good. You do have the attention of the full board right now.
Very good. Okay, well, that's great to be a planet. I'll kick it off if you want, Bob, and then hand it over to you in a few seconds.
That's fine. Go right ahead.
Okay, great. So this is Landy Filon joining with Barbara McKee today. We do a presentation on your investment in the White Oak Pinnacle Fund. I'm, as you probably know, the head of marketing at White Oak, and I've been with the firm for 5 years. Barbara McKee is the founding partner of the firm, and currently on the operating committee, the investment committee, and a couple other committees too, I think, previously listed.
I think
on
I'm on the committee as well.
She's in charge of the committee. Anyway, today she's going to give you a rundown on your investment here, how we're doing, a bit of a summary, and hopefully we'll realize how well we're doing in this investment and open to any questions you may have. So you have a handout there at the moment, and please refer to that as Barbara is presenting, and I'll hand it over to her.
Thanks, Landy. Thank you, everyone, for your attention today. I'd like to go through our short deck starting on page 2. You see there a snapshot of the White Oak Pinnacle Fund as of the end of the third quarter of 2016. The inception date for this fund was March 15, 2012, and the net asset value to date is $362.6 million. There are 53 loans in the portfolio. The average position size is 10.4. Assets under management for the fund in total is $403.9 million. 100% of these loans are first lien senior secured, and there are sector limitations applied for diversification. You can see those in the pie chart on the right-hand page of page 2. The largest sectors are telecom services at 18%, industrials at 17%, and tied for second place is technology at 17%. Spending just a second more on the right-hand side of the page, our current active pipeline of deals is an aggregate of $3.1 billion in size. The average size of loans in the pipeline is $28.2 million, so those are the opportunities that we'll be realizing on for you over the next coming quarters.
Hey, Barbara, can I ask a quick question? Barbara, can I ask a quick question really fast? This is Rick.
Hi, Rick. Absolutely. Chime in.
Okay. On that page 2, lower left, there's a remaining capital commitment of 41.2. Is that just the amount of capacity that just wasn't deployed?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. And it gets a little bit complicated because when we deploy capital as loans repay, we do have the right to recycle once
right.
into new loans. So when you see recallable distribution, $124.1 million. There is that amount potentially available also, but the remaining capital commitment from the original capital for the fund in aggregate, this is not just Stantera's commitment,
yep,
is 41.2.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. You'll see, again, in that lower left corner, the capital commitment originally was $364.1 million. Capital previously drawn, 447. Again, just to reiterate, that is larger than the original capital commitment because capital is redrawn multiple times, if you will. There's a recycle right. Many of our loans repay early, and so we do have the ability to recycle that capital into new loans during the investment period. Okay, turning over to page four. I wanted to spend a couple of minutes giving you a more detailed picture of two loans that are new to the portfolio. The first is a company called Growell Brand. Many of you may be familiar with this company from your own visits to Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmart, etc. This company, which is codenamed Project Cover in our documents, so you will see that name going forward. They are a natural and organic lawn and garden products company. That means that they manufacture mulching products, fertilizer products, ground cover products, etc. So both blended soils and fertilizers. Their most popular brands are sold under their own name and also under white labeled names through big box retailers and various independent channels. They were founded in 2006. They are headquartered in Arizona, and they have seven different collecting and processing yards throughout the Southwest. They are very active throughout the western and southwestern part of the country. We were introduced to this opportunity through their financial advisor. The company had hired an advisor to help them, and that advisor had a relationship with the originator on the White Oak team. White Oak funded the loan in order to refinance the existing lender and also to provide additional working capital needs for the company. They have a very long-standing customer base. This is a fast-growing industry segment, especially for their core products. And they have what is the oldest label brand name in this industry sector in the United States, dating back to 1855. The exit strategy, if necessary, for this loan is likely a sale of the company as a going concern. We would not be looking to liquidate or break this company up into parts. The sum of its parts is greater than the whole. They have, as I said, used our proceeds for refinancing and working capital. And you can see the metrics there on the right-hand side of the page. They have 150 employees currently, and the loan was provided in two separate tranches. The tranche A loan, $12.2 million in size, and the tranche B loan, $4.1 million in size. The tranche A loan is secured by the equipment of the company. That's the equipment loan, and that has a lower interest rate associated with it, that's 7%. Tranche B is for working capital. That is $4.1 million in size. That has the higher coupon associated with it of 11%. And the collateral package is across the entire loan. So this is secured by all of the assets and also a pledge of the equity of the company. You can see there that the amortization is $500,000 per year on the equipment loan. So that loan is amortizing naturally and de-risking over time. If the loan were to repay early in the first year, we would achieve a 2% premium for our investors. And if it repaid in the second year before maturity, that would be an additional premium of 1%. The commitment amount on this loan was $16.3 million. And as I said, it was underwritten for a two-year term. There was a transaction fee of 1%, all of which goes to the investors. So this is what I would term a relatively low-tech investment by the fund. a product that is, you know, readily understandable by all investors and one you would see on a weekly basis in your local stores. Turning to page 5, you see an example of a more high-tech investment by the fund. This company is named Opera Solutions. It's codenamed Project Watson within the portfolio. And they provide advanced analytics software for companies that work with big data is the terminology. So these are enterprise customers in financial services, major banks, healthcare companies, travel industry, hospitality, retail, telecommunications, etc., as well as selected government entities. So these are companies that all use very intensive databases and data-intensive applications within their business. The primary value to the customers of Opera Solutions is the ability to use this large amount of data and extract the information that they need in order to answer customer inquiries, market effectively, and answer customer inquiries. The company is 12 years old. It was founded in 2004. The current chairman and CEO was an original founder of the company, and they have transitioned over the past 3 years from a purely consulting basis to a platform software company, so they offer a suite of products to their clients. Similar to GrowWell, the company had hired a financial advisor who had a relationship with White Oak, and this is how we were introduced to the opportunity. We financed the loan in order to take out their existing, pre-existing lender and to fund additional working capital needs. And the company has a very strong flow of contractual customers. They have a compelling portion of market share and best-in-class product architecture that they provide to their clients. Again, this company would most likely, in an exit strategy, be sold as a going concern. That would be the best execution of value for our investors. It is a currently performing loan, and the projected IRR on this investment is 12.6%. That does not include any premiums for an early prepayment. You can see that this loan is a bit longer in term than the previous example. This one is 5 years. The premium for prepayment in the first year would be 3% above the amount of principal, so a 103 call premium that steps down over time. And none of those call premiums are included in the projected IRR because obviously we can't predict if the company would prepay and if so when. There is likewise amortization in this opportunity. It begins in the 7th quarter of the loan, and it's calculated as 75% of their excess cash flow if the total leverage is greater than 3x over EBITDA. That is calculated as 50% if total leverage is between 1.5 and 3x, and there is no cash flow sweep if the total leverage is under 1.5x. That would be an extremely healthy performing company at that point, and we would not sweep their excess cash. So that is just a brief summary for you of the background on this loan. You can see the remaining metrics on the right-hand side of page 5. Like the other positions in the portfolio, it's first lien senior secured. The loan amount at origination was $65 million. The commitment amount was $70 million, so there is an additional $5 million that we could fund at our discretion if the company identified a need for that and was performing with the ability to draw that additional $5 million. Interest rate is calculated cash amount of 3 month LIBOR plus 9%, and an additional paid in kind or bullet payment at the end that is equal to 2.5% of the principal amount. Transaction fee, 2% on the commitment amount of $70 million, and that again, all of that flows to the investors. And the collateral package for this loan is 100% of the assets of the company. Turning to page 6, you see a projection of capital deployment out It picks up the last two quarters of 2016 and then goes out over the coming 3 years. So if you look at the gray line that starts at about 90% and then decreases over time, that is the percentage of the capital in the White Oak Pinnacle Fund that has been that is being deployed. So that falls from 90% over time because that fund is completely deployed over the next coming quarters. You will see a bright blue line that starts out at 0% that's labeled Spectrum. That is the next closed-end fund offered by White Oak. That is going to be launched in the first quarter of 2017. So you see that bright blue line starting to pick up in first quarter and then accelerating and increasing in deployment through the next coming three annual cycles. The dark blue line at the top shows the combined deployment of both funds. So there's a slight dip projected in the second quarter of 2018. This is just based on our pipeline and deal projection out over the coming 3 years. But you see that on average, the combined deployment of the Spectrum and Pinnacle funds increases out through the end of 2019. So that's just a graphic way of showing you performance of White Oak projected over the next coming quarter cycles. On page 7, you get what is probably a more interesting page for the audience on this phone call. This has the loan metrics at origination out over the Pinnacle Fund, and then your specific highlights on the bottom of page 7. So you can see the number of loans broken out by opportunistic credits, equipment loans, and asset-based loans. You can see the originated capital, the tenor of our loans, the leverage, cash yield, and total yield. And this, again, is on a portfolio as a whole basis. And that's reflected in the pie chart at the right. So that's for the total portfolio. Your own highlights on the bottom of page 7, you can see that your original commitment was $40 million. Distributions year-to-date for 2016 are $3.4 million, and distributions inception-to-date is $8.4 million. The net asset value of your portion of the portfolio is $36.9 million today, and since inception, you've achieved a growth return on your investment of 15.2%. And that correlates to a net return of 9.4% after all fees. That's kind of a whirlwind tour through the deck. Just wanted to point out to you the kind of high-level metrics both for the fund and for your own investment, and I would pause and ask if there are any questions.
I have a question. From a very fundamental perspective, does the potential for deregulation going forward have any effect on any potential dislocation that exists in this space? I guess that's my question. Does it have, and maybe on the size of the pipeline going forward?
Obviously it does. The devil is in the details. So the question would be how quickly deregulation could open up this market to additional traditional banking lenders as well as to additional alternative lenders. The other piece of it that is a complicating factor is that the regulation that applies in the lending market is not just unilateral banking regulations within the United States. There are multinational treaties to which we are a party. And so the Basel Accords, for example, that is probably the premier example of a multinational accord that restricts banking activity and lending activity in general within the U.S. That cannot be changed by a particular administration in a short time frame. So while we, of course, see the potential for deregulation opening up the market, increasing competition, decreasing spreads, and therefore making our business, ultimately less attractive in terms of margins, That cannot be done by the U.S. unilaterally across the board, nor can it be done in a short time frame.
Okay.
I would add to that that the trend in the multilateral decisions has been to increase regulation. So there is a limit to what we can do you know, within the U.S. by ourselves.
Thanks, Barbara.
Anytime.
Anything else for Barbara? Okay, it looks like we're good.
Excellent. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out to us. We're here to answer your questions and give you as much information as you'd like.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Have a good holiday, too.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, we'll move on to item 7, Executive Director Investment, 7A, 2016 Quarter 3 Auxiliary Investment Report.
Okay, before I go on to this, I want to make a couple announcements having to do with the investment side of things. I got a phone call and an email from Marilyn Freeman from Cap Prospects. She let us know that Keeley Asset Management has been acquired by a firm called Teton Advisors. And it was due to the passing of the founder of Keeley. I can't remember his name. But his son will be the new executive director, I guess, of this new combined firm. We did not lose our portfolio manager, Scott Chin, I believe is his name. He is still going to be managing our portfolio. She said they sat down with everybody, talked about it, and they don't feel like there's any concern right now within the firm, the structure, the way it's laid out, but they will keep us advised and keep looking into this as time goes on. Keeley's actually been one of the better ones in the stable of Cap Prospects as well, so I don't anticipate there being any negatives from this. PIMCO also let us know that their high yield exposure went above the max of 10% to 10.04%, so just very little, and that was due to the downgrade of Wynn Resorts, a bond in their portfolio, and they suggest that we just hold the course there, not to liquidate the security within the portfolio, but not to increase it as well. This happens quite a bit, by the way. This is not unusual. And then finally, talked to Raven last week. They are planning their first annual meeting for the Raven 3 Fund in April or May of next year, and they asked and we agreed and signed an amendment to the contract to extend the investment period by 1 month.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Why?
I spoke to them and they said you did not.
I thought we sent it, yeah.
We did.
We'll double check on that.
Okay.
It's only 1 month.
We didn't.
Yeah, if we did, then it dropped. But I thought we did.
They got the 51%.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah,
it's
kind of
okay.
A moot point.
Maybe that's why we hadn't heard from them if we didn't do it.
All right. Yeah, I thought we did.
Yeah. Kind of got caught up in the sacker.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Anyway, doing 15.
Right. That's all I have on those three things. Yeah. I'm going to turn the light off. What I want to do today, instead of just kind of glossing over really fast the auxiliary report, I'd like to kind of go over it again in slightly more detail just to kind of remind you of what it is we do and what these numbers actually mean. And we've also actually added a couple more new reports to this, and so I want to be able to explain this to you. It's this one right here, right?
No.
It's this one.
User calendar.
Okay, and how do I make this bigger? Okay, so I'm just going to go through these again really fast, and if you can hand me this, it's got a little pointer on here. I just want to make sure we all understand. Oh, great, it doesn't work though on the white, a little bit. So this is, let me go to the next exhibit. This is our investment fee summary for the last fiscal year, and what we can see is we've spent a total of 50.3 basis points to manage the portfolio. That includes managerial, custodial, and investment consultant fees. You can see what the asset classes are in general, what their fees are, and you can see that direct lending is essentially the largest consumer of our fees to the fund. One of the things that I wanted to show you, two things. One, you can see that the infrastructure, Morgan Stanley, is about 700 basis points, which seems extraordinary, which it is extraordinary, but there's a reason for that. And the reason is because we choose to show fees as a percentage of the assets that have actually been deployed by the manager. So, as you know, we pay fees on what's the total commitment until the commitment period is over. But we want to show you what the fees are based on how much money we've actually got deployed in that asset class. We feel it's a little more transparent, even though it may not be indicative of the long run, which it's not. That number will slowly come down. But nonetheless, it is a reality, the way we're paying our fees. The other thing I wanted to point out, something on the good side, is the 1.9 basis point, custodial basis point. This is a really low number compared to what we see at other systems our size, and I think Sackers even referenced this during the conference, that funds our size generally pay custodial fees of between 4 and 5 basis points, I believe was the number that I heard. So just wanted to point out that our custodial fees are pretty low relative to our peers. Any questions on any of that? Okay. This is our value-added summary. This is for the last quarter from July through September. We had a very good year. As you know, if you remember from a quarter ago, we lost $39 million to the passive investment. This year, this quarter alone, we made up over a third of that, $15 million in value added. So if you look at this, if you want to really understand what this is, there's a lot of information on this page, but if you just look at the total non-alternative portfolio line, you can see the actual invested assets in this exhibit. What we do is we take the total assets that are available to each of the managers and we subtract out the average uninvested cash to give us what they actually have invested. We throw in the net cash flows into and out of the fund. And then this is the passive return. So theoretically, this is what we could earn if we chose to invest all our assets passively. Okay? And so what this is a choice between active and passive investing. And so this is the theoretical return that we would have earned had we chose to invest passively. This is the return of the extra dollar amount or bang for our buck that we get by choosing to not invest passively but to invest actively. And so what we do is we take, we subtract our fees from our active return and we get our value added. Hopefully that makes sense. We can see that Dodge & Cox did very, very well. They added $8.4 million in value, and Jackson Square did very well. So the large cap space, for some reason, did very well the last quarter. And then we got our laggards. Legato lost $2 million to the passive investment. Cap Prospects a little underwater at $800,000. And there was one other, Fidelity or Pyramus, lost $2.3 million to the passive investment. Okay, so this is a new, this is going to take a little bit of explanation. This is why I've had a little bit of nerves about this, explaining these things here. So we had a request from a trustee if we could start to get value added for our alternative portfolios. And of course I made the comment like I always do. I think things are always easier than what they always actually turn out to be. And I said, yeah, be very simple. Well, when it got down to trying to figure out a value added for our alternatives, I realized there's no literature out there. There's nothing that started pointing me in the right direction. And so I kind of had to do this on the fly, but I spent a fair amount of time doing this, and I think that I've got a method that works to show what the value added is. There is a problem, though, a fundamental theoretical problem with this exhibit, and I'll get to it at the very end, but I want to show you how I derive the value added. So if we just start with the first line, Medley Capital, these are the cash receipts. So this is the money we've received back from Medley, and what I do is I take all the cash receipts from the day that we actually receive them and I accumulate them forward at the benchmark return. Benchmark return in this case is 9% constant. That's the problem that I'm going to talk about later on, but nonetheless. So I accumulate them forward, all the cash receipts at 9% to the valuation date, which is 6/30/2016. I have the fund balance from the fund itself. I sum those two and I say this investment has a value to Stan Serra today of $38.5 million. That includes what the capital balance is of the fund and the accumulated value of all the cash flows from the day we received them to 6/30/2016 at the benchmark return. Then I calculate a theoretical passive balance. And the way I do that is I take all of our contributions that we've made to this fund since inception and I roll them forward at 9%, because we assume that we could invest in a benchmark and instead of investing with Medley, we could take that money and invest it in the benchmark and earn a constant 9%. So I roll forward all those cash contributions that we made and I get a theoretical passive fund balance of 42.2, whatever that number is. I'm having a hard time seeing. And so then what I do is I just subtract the difference, and that's the value added between the two. Okay, so does that make sense, the methodology of how I did the calculations? Yes, pretty much?
Yeah, the assumption of 9%.
That's the problem.
Yep.
That's what I want to talk about right now. So an assumption of, one of the qualities or the things that you need in a valid benchmark is that it has to be investable. And I know of no investment.
Don't look at me. I don't either. I wouldn't be here.
We'd be 100% in it.
We'd go home. Exactly. We wouldn't even need to meet. So there is a fundamental problem. This benchmark assumes that all the cash receipts we've made and all the distributions or contributions that we could have made to the benchmark can earn 9%, which is just fundamentally impossible. So this value added, I don't think it's a true picture of how well these funds are doing from a value perspective. So I need to get with Ed and I need to talk about some other benchmark that we can use that actually has some value and that's investable. Something, because when we talk about value added and we talk about passive versus active investing, what it really is a choice. It's a choice whether we choose to invest passively or it's a choice whether we choose to invest actively. And you should be able to do either to be able to judge the value of the investment that you're in. We can't do both. We cannot invest in an investment that gives us a constant 9%. So this is a flawed analysis. I think the methodology of how I'm calculating the value added works. It's just that I'm applying that methodology to a benchmark that's invalid, and I don't trust the answers in the far right.
What would it be like if you used our target?
Our actuarial assumption?
Mm-hmm. 7.25.
Yeah. Hey, the only thing is that's not valid either. Yeah, well, it is valid. I could use the month-to-month, I guess. But, like I said, we need to talk. Is there some sort of proxy for this asset class that has a passive investment that I could choose to invest in? And that would be something that you and I need to talk about.
So, Rick, how the money that's, we commit a certain amount of dollars, right? And then, but out of which only a certain portion is put into investment, right? The rest just sits. What do we get on the money that's sitting on the sidelines?
It's in our portfolio. That's a good, in other words, the money that we haven't given to the managers to deploy.
Right.
It's invested in our portfolio. That may not be such a bad thing to consider. It's definitely worth a debate. Yeah. I would definitely agree with that. And then the other thing is I need to be able to get benchmark returns for our real estate. For some reason, Northern Trust does not have benchmark returns. They're not giving us that in the data, so I've got to figure out. Again, you and I can talk. I've got 2.5 months now to shore this up for the next quarterly report. But we'll figure out where I can get the data for the real estate.
It seems to me like the only thing you can do would be maybe go to a benchmark of like a Russell or something like that, because you know if you put your money there, you can get that, or to Treasuries. But there isn't anything else that's definable.
Right.
You can only look at what's definable right somewhere else.
So I talked to, that's interesting you say, I talked to M. Serra. Obviously now I have a connection at M. Serra. they use for one of theirs the Russell 3000 and then they add like 300 basis points to it. So, but it's just something that we need to talk about and then we can come back to you guys and ask you
why do they add 3 to it? Is it to make up for the extra fees, or?
Well, I think this asset class is expected to earn a higher rate of return.
So that's probably private equity, I'm guessing.
Yes.
They're using Russell 3. They're probably saying small cap like in nature, illiquidity premium that we expect to get 3% on. We could quibble about whether 3 is the right number or not, but that is a common methodology. This is private credit, and I wouldn't use a private or a public equity benchmark to replicate credit exposure. So I think more about more like high yield, maybe something like that.
So what's that number, Ray?
What number?
The Russell plus 3 or whatever.
It would change every month. It would be different. Whatever the Russell 3000 returned, we would add 300 basis points, and that would. But again, at least that's a. Well, even that, I don't know if it's investable. Would something like that even be?
No, because you can't get the 300
you can't.
Basis points anymore. Is the 9% that we're using there, that's not the hurdle rate, is it? Or how did the 9 come about?
I have no idea. This is an SIS legacy. Does anybody?
Hurdle 8%, wasn't it?
I think the hurdle's 8.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Most hurdles are 8, so okay.
Yeah.
It's something else then.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. But this is something that's not overcomable. We can definitely overcome it. And I do believe that the methodology, if we do find the benchmark that works, mm-hmm. and that's some proxy for high yield, we can apply the methodology to that. We can assume that all our distributions were invested in that benchmark, and they earned the returns that the benchmark did over the period of time. And we can assume that the contributions that we receive at some point in time would then be turned around and invested in that high yield passive investment to come up with a value add. So I think the methodology works, unless you see a flaw there. It's just that the benchmark is my problem right now.
So that's an interesting choice of having any dividends or any income generated by the investment to be reinvested.
Right.
And that's not necessarily true. I mean, that's kind of the yield to maturity count in a bond portfolio. Where
exactly.
Presumably you could do that.
That's where I got that from.
You actually have private markets, and when is your capital called? You can't really control that. So.
Understood, but isn't if you have a passive investment, that's a benchmark. Well, if you have a passive investment, can't you choose to get into and out of that investment whenever you want?
Presumably.
Okay.
But here, so what you're suggesting, I haven't seen done anywhere. Like this is whole new stuff.
I know, I didn't find anything either.
Okay.
I thought long and hard about it.
He's going to write the book on this.
I guess my question to you would be, as long as there is a benchmark, whether it's a great proxy for this investment or not, as long as there is a benchmark and you can get into it and get out of it at any time, then this methodology would work. Because you could take the cash and instead of giving it to the investment, you give it to the benchmark. You could sell your...
Conceptually, yes, but then when you get to the conclusion where you get to the column on the right, you say, okay, so what's the value added here? You've created a really high hurdle for anything to exceed it. Because that benchmark, being able to get in and out of it and getting that kind of return
for
investing, is a beautiful thing.
Absolutely.
So
without any transaction costs.
Right.
No doubt.
Right. So anything's going to come out as a negative on value add. And
no doubt.
Scratching your head saying, why are we in this stuff?
No doubt. I mean, we could adjust it by fees. We do with the other value added report as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So absolutely, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
All right. And this you guys all know about. This is just our private credit, direct lending, and all our real estate and infrastructure. This is the cash flows. And you can start to see now the IRRs at the very bottom on the right since inception. White Oak is actually, as of 6/30/2016, has been a pretty good investment for us on a net basis. So this calculation of 8.11, it simply takes all those cash flows on the right-hand side, plug them into Excel using the IRR function, and using that capital balance number right here, we can calculate an IRR, and it's about 8.11%. So this, to me, as long as that capital balance is an approximately right number, this is a fairly decent representation of the internal rate of return because it is based on pure cash flow. So if we go down, we can look at Medley. It's about 4.5%. Raven is 3.9%. And then we can see here's Greenfield, who we just talked to today. They're at 13.3%.
American is 16.6, and these are quite high. North Haven is still a fairly young fund. We expect those to. These are almost too soon to be looking at actually right now, but nonetheless they are on our radar, and we will continue to update them. And Raven 3 is pretty brand new as well too. Cash flow report, you know about that. That's self-explanatory. And then finally, I want to talk about, this is another new analysis that I'd like to show you. So this is what you would call and what you have heard as the J-curve, essentially. And so this shows you the blue bars are all the contributions we've made at the specific date that we've made them. The red bars are all the distributions we've gotten back from the investment since inception. And then the green line is the J-curve, which is just the cumulative sum of all the contributions, whether positive or negative. So I know that we've been telling you that we are breaking out of the J-curve and we are starting to head upward. And so this is a visual of that. And we're going to continue to show you this every quarter as well. So through my research, I found that it generally takes 4 to 5 years, 4 to 6 years before you pierce the X-axis, before you've gotten all your money back, and then you start to climb above the X-axis. And this White Oak investment, we're about almost 3 years into it right now, I guess, yeah. And so we will just keep, I'm going to keep throwing this stuff out at you each quarter. I'm not going to go through these analysis like we are today unless you want me to, but I wouldn't mind doing this every year or so just to kind of refresh your memory about what it is we're showing you here. So I'm just throwing it out at you. There's Raven, and it's bottomed out too. And there is Medley. Any questions on any of these? Okay, that's all I have.
So this will give you something to do over the Thanksgiving holiday, and you'll have something back for us in a week or two, right?
Yeah, right.
There you go. Okay, moving on to item 8, Verus Investment Consultant, 8A Flash Report for October 30th, 2016.
You need to leave that up and run it, or somebody? Yeah, we were actually going to bring Ed's treasury.
Oh, okay. We won't be getting that right away.
So lights on and off.
Just one of them.
One of them,
yeah.
That's all you want. That's all you get.
I think we have the flash report next in the PDF. I'm going to skip over that. I'll come back to it later when we get into the performance. I'd like to touch on the macroeconomic landscape first, which is titled our fourth quarter investment landscape. I will. I'm going to take that order.
What are we doing out of order?
I'm going to come back to the flash report. I'm going to start with the review of the markets first. Okay, so behind tab 1, we have our fourth quarter investment landscape. And before we begin with that, I'd like to just recap some of my predictions from the third quarter investment landscape, which were that the Cubs would win the World Series, and that Trump would be elected, and they'll vote those. I hope you follow every word I say.
You're good.
Page 4, I'd like to hit a couple things here, just real quick. This is what drove the market in Q3. Upper left-hand side, taking a look at the probabilities that the Fed raises rates in December. You can see that in June, it was effectively 0.9% was the odds, and it increased sequentially every month until September, got up to 51% as of last week with the better news on the GDP front, and we got some good labor news and some good productivity news, and we put the election behind us. That number was up to 94%, and today it's effectively 100%. So Fed will be raising rates in December. The question now is, will it be 25 basis points? Probably, but we'll see. So that's pretty interesting, because typically when the Fed raises rates, equity markets sell off, or at least when there's rumors that they will, the equity markets sell off, and and the bond market starts doing funky things. And here we are sitting at all-time highs for the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ, the Dow, the S&P 500. They all closed up again today. And so it's kind of interesting. It's like the equity markets are telling the Fed, yep, it's okay. Go ahead, raise rates. We're fine with that now. Next line down is the 10-year note. And you can see this series of data largely in the 1.6s, touching 1.59 in September. It got a little bit below that even. It was into the 1.5s pretty solidly. Started the year at 1.9%. That is now at about 2.3%. So the bond market has sold off, at least the Treasury market has. And that's important too, because that's partially indicative of what we're anticipating with a Trump administration being higher growth and people selling out of bonds for that reason, and also just general supply-demand imbalances there, and a flight then to equities as the money comes out of the bond market going into the equity side. So we expect to see that hit our bond side of the portfolio, and so that's important. It's not just the 10-year, but it's the accompanying credits and other bonds. And then we have the election. That's all old news now, and then the bottom is about the pound sterling versus the U.S. dollar. And those numbers are important because of Brexit. And so here we're showing that the pound was, £1 cost $1.46 back in end of April. Today that's about $1.25. So the dollar has gotten stronger, the pound has gotten weaker, and that's pretty noticeable. Year to date, the pound is down about 16%. So what that means for this whole Brexit thing is that their economy now has to pay a lot more for everything that's imported. And oh, by the way, if you're in Britain, a lot of things are imported. So they're really importing inflation there. At the same time, they're introducing economic uncertainty because what is a Brexit? How do you manage a Brexit? No one knows. No one's done this before. And so their central bank lowered rates to try to be more stimulative. So they're lowering rates at a time where it looks like inflation is going to be creeping up. That's an odd place for a central bank to be. Usually they like to be raising rates in rising inflation environments. So we want to watch this one closely because this populist movement that took place in Great Britain that led to the Brexit vote, you could kind of credit something similar going on here with what got Trump elected. And you're hearing a lot of things in France as they have an election coming up about who the front runners are there day to day. And this populist movement is big. If Brexit happens smoothly and it gives a roadmap for others, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Does the European Union even stay together? Because France is talking about leaving. If France left, it's almost game over at that point. So it's pretty sizable.
They're payment. Getting tired of subsidizing Spain and Ireland and Greece.
Yep.
I can see by a lot of it. Yep.
So yesterday's journal has the euro and next couple months at $7. I got 91 cents or something like that.
Yeah, so I got this question this morning actually. This was kind of interesting. The euro a year ago in December was basically right where it is today. It's about 106 to the dollar. And in May, it was up at about 116. So it had risen pretty nicely and then come back. So today, we're right about where we were a year ago. So going down to one would just be another 6% or so. Totally doable, right? That's totally doable.
So if the European Union breaks apart, that makes my lira, marks, and pesetas and francs good again.
Very real.
Their exports are being cheaper to us. So.
Yes. Yes.
That'd be good for Aston Martin.
Yeah, you probably told him right. Three things that would be good. Because there isn't anything else. Twisted maybe.
Let's skip ahead. Let's skip ahead a few pages to page 8. This is the labor market. We talk a lot about labor market. The left-hand side has the headline number. That's the U3 number that you see quoted often as being about a 5% unemployment rate, and that's charted in blue. The green is the participation rate, and so we're not seeing a lot of progress there. If we took this chart back a few more years, that participation rate would be closer to 68%. And so the delta between us having 68% participation and where we are today at 63, a little bit under 63, is somewhere between 5 and 10 million people still not working. So they're in the calculus. But the middle chart gives us some ray of hope because this is really showing some nice improvement. This middle chart is the months that people are unemployed, so the average duration. So back at the end of the global financial crisis, that was about 40, I'm sorry, weeks, not months. 40 weeks, and now that's come down to about 27, 28, and the long-term average is closer to 14. That's important because as people are unemployed, the longer they're unemployed, the more likely they are to stay unemployed. And that's a real issue for an economy, is that how do you get these people retrained and re-engaged and out of their parents' basements and what have you. So it's good to see that number heading that right direction. But this also is probably a good indication of why the Fed has been so hesitant to raise rates. That it would be nice to, but we still have some real problems there. So that's one insight into what they're dealing with on that front. Page 15 has a quick look at international statistics. We do have a good bit of international exposure in our portfolio, so probably worth taking a look at this. The top line of the United States, just for reference, with GDP, inflation, and unemployment. A fairly similar story in Western Europe, GDP of 1.8%. Page 15.
15. Skipped a lot of pages.
Yeah, I'm trying to get through it. Be here till midnight. As long-winded as I am. So Western Europe at 1.8% economic growth, modest inflation, higher unemployment. Japan, a lot of stimulus in Japan, trying to get that economy going, and so it is having positive results there.
Question for you on that. BRIC is still the four listed below it there?
Yes. Yeah, so sort of a shorthand way of the emerging markets. And India and China are obviously the ones that stick out because the economic growth is so high. Yeah. And China has come down from what was 10, you know, low double digit growth rates of 10%, and purposely, because their economy was overheating, dialing that down. So they did. They got it down below 7 now. But it's also good to keep in mind that because they did have all those years of big time economic growth, that this 6.7 is now applied to a larger base. So they are a bigger, larger component of the global GDP, and that growth is good. And on the left-hand side, there's some text there that tells you that the IMF is now estimating a 3% growth rate for 2017. So still modest growth globally. And the last thing I'll touch on is page 30. Skip through a whole bunch of pages here. Take a look at domestic equities. Now that we're through reporting season with the S&P 500, we have some good numbers to report for a change. So I think last quarter I had mentioned that we had 5 sequential quarters of year-over-year earnings decline, and we hadn't seen that in a long time. So that wasn't looking too good. And this quarter, third quarter, estimates were for another contraction of 2 to 2.3%. And largely due to oil, which is what the chart in the lower right-hand column shows you. But actual results are better. So actual results are showing about a 3% increase in earnings, which is nice. 72% of the companies are beating on their earnings estimates, 55% beating on sales. So both those numbers are better than expected. And now we're sitting at a forward price-to-earnings multiple of 16.7. Historically, that's still pretty high. And so good that we're in a low interest rate environment and all of that good stuff. So nice backdrop. Good that we're seeing growth. But domestic equities still look pretty pricey. So it would take some more growth to justify that. Or maybe it comes to fruition. We'll see over time.
The stock market went over 19,000 today.
Yes, it did. Yeah, so 16.7 might be a little bit dated then. Maybe 16.8 or so. And let's jump ahead to page 44. Give us some insight into how our plan has done by taking a look at the S&P 500 and the sectors in it. So technology was the top performing sector, which was nice to see. It had been in the bottom the last couple quarters, so a big recovery there. And telecom and utilities back down to the bottom. So we had seen those as being strong performers in the past. And it was always this kind of weird thing, like, these are companies that issue big dividends. The price doesn't change all that much. Why do you really want to invest in them? And it was kind of the flight to safety story in the volatile market. And if you take a look at the right-hand side, the one-year ending, telecom, even though it pulled back almost 6% in the quarter, is still the number one sector. followed by IT, and even utilities, 17% for the year. So pretty strong returns for those sectors, but this quarter kind of returning to normal. And then page 45 has the major indices, upper left-hand corner. Domestic equities positive for the quarter, 3, 4, 5% returns. Small caps, the Russell 2000 was the strongest with 9%, and that has continued through October and November. International equity down below, positive returns here, 6% for developed markets, emerging market 9%, EM Asia is the winner at 10.5%. Upper right-hand side, fixed income markets, largely flat as we would expect, slightly positive with exception of some treasury exposures there for the quarter. And then down below, some of the other asset classes like commodities, REITs, emerging market debt, and then some currencies. So let me pause there, see if there are any questions. And if not, we can move ahead to agenda item A, the flash report. Just a quick update for October. Total plan, minus 1.2% for the month. Fiscal year to date, positive 3.1. And calendar year to date, 4.5. So a bit of a pullback in October. We're seeing that it's the equity markets domestically that came back about 2%. International equity down 1. And fixed income also down about 0.3. So no real safe place to hide. No specific comments on the managers there. And then page 2 has the real estate exposures and private markets.
So I have a question on page 2, Ed. We heard from Greenfield today. Mm-hmm. Are they now in a little bit in the direct lending business as well? Does it seem like?
Oh, with their real estate debt? Yeah, it is kind of like that.
I mean, are they equipped for that? Or do we allow them to, I guess?
We should ask that one on the phone. That's a good question. Yeah, it's part of their strategy, so they do it. They had 9% exposure today. I think they're just highlighting that that's where they're seeing opportunity, that the markets, the real estate markets, look pretty fully valued, and we're hearing that from a lot of managers, that there just aren't the opportunities there than what we once saw. Most of the core properties, the core managers that we're seeing, used to be clicking along at about a 3 to 4% quarterly return, with about 1% from income, 2 to 3% from appreciation. At 2 to 3% on appreciation, is now about 1%. So they're getting.
So they're shifting to compensate for that.
That's a question for staff. Are we sure that they talked about carrying debt in the contract that we had?
Right now, I'm off the top of my head. I'd have to say I need to research that.
So I think that's the question that we need to go.
I'm sorry, I missed something.
They're questioning the fact that Greenfield has debt, and it's more like acting more like a direct lender in part of its portfolio. And so I've told Jeff, we will research that and make sure that they're not outside of the mandate.
Yeah, they can, though. I remember that is in their prospectus that we saw in there, because Gordon was pretty much asking questions about that. The level that they can carry, I don't know.
It probably would be good for us to reacquaint ourselves with that. Yeah. You brought up the question, are they prepared for doing that?
Yeah.
I'm guessing they are, or I don't think they would have done it.
No.
It's good for us to know what that is.
I know that all three of them, Prime, American, and Greenfield, were asked the question, and they all are allowed to up to a certain point. Absolutely. I just don't remember what the numbers are.
Let's turn to tab 2 and take a look at the quarterly performance. Yeah, the bigger book. There's two books, of course, the bigger book. So starting the quarter at $1.76 billion, net cash outflows of $6.8 million, more than offset by the investment gain of $79.3 million, so ending market value of $1.835.6 billion. Pages 2 and 3.
Where are you at?
Okay.
Back to the same book.
Big book.
Big book, yeah.
Tab 2.
I'll keep you awake if nothing else.
You're doing a great job.
We opened the door. There wasn't much oxygen in here.
Pages 2 and 3 have the asset allocation. Everything checks out here. On page 3, we have the yes column against the IPS ranges to make sure we're playing according to the rules here. We are getting close on the small cap side. So domestic equity, small cap growth, and small cap value. We have a max of 4.7 on small cap growth. We're at 4.6. We have a max of 5.0 on small cap value. We're at 4.9. So we're close. Given all the other changes we have lined up for the portfolio, though, I wouldn't recommend doing any rebalancing at this time. But it is likely we're going to come up against those maxes. That being said, if you provide direction that we should do something about rebalancing, we can certainly draw that up and work through that analysis. Page 4 gives our performance relative to peers and a pretty strong quarter. And you can see year-to-date, 76th percentile, quarter, 9th percentile. So you can see we haven't had a good quarter in a while, so this is a nice change. So I think we should just pause here and see where that went. And then looking down the column, we get outperformance through pretty much every asset class. U.S. equity outperformed, international equity, U.S. fixed income, real estate, and then direct lending and infrastructure are just placeholders there in terms of the zeros. And also reflective that we changed the methodology in lagging performance, and as a result, we were going to have this quarter showing zero returns as we lag. Page 6 is my favorite page because this is the only page in the performance report that holds us honest against the asset allocation study that we do with you. So, you know, thinking through that asset allocation work, we talk about what's the right level of risk that we can assume, and what's our expected return off of that. And we usually end up with something around a 7% expected return in line with our actuarial assumption, with an expected annualized standard deviation of 11 or 12. And here we're seeing that over the past 5 years, we've gotten a 10% return, nice, with lower standard deviation of 7. So both risk and return have been favorable for us. And then the charts below show risk return charted as well as upmarket and downmarket capture ratio. And that chart on the right is interesting because our fund, the red square, is showing that we get upmarket capture ratio of 107%, downmarket capture ratio of 122%. So the plan doesn't play defense really well. It plays offense well, but during those market pullbacks are the times where we suffer. And I think the steps that we're talking about with the asset allocation help build in more defense. And in fact, the U.S. Treasury piece we're talking about later today is a big part of that. Taking a look on pages 7 and 8 for the individual strategies, Rick had mentioned that Jackson Square had a nice quarter, and here you're seeing it, 18th percentile against their peers, bringing up year-to-date and one-year numbers. So that first couple of quarters they had that were really detrimental that we spoke about and having the Valiant exposure and what have you, still keeps them in 95th percentile year to date, but that quarter number has much improved. Dodge and Cox, an even better story here, fourth percentile, and that has really changed their profile quite a bit. So they're having a pretty strong year to date now in line with their index and 30th percentile. So the index has been tough to beat, and they've come very close, not quite there, but come close. And then skipping ahead a few pages, or one more page, page 8 on the fixed income side, just wanted to highlight Dodge and Cox. And fixed income has also done really well, third percentile here. Overweight to corporate credits, which they always have an overweight to corporate credits, and underweight to U.S. Treasuries worked out pretty well. And page 14 has the schedule of fees for each of the investment strategies, which I think is also covered well by this presentation in terms of what we're actually paying for this. Everything checks out according to the expectations against the manager agreements here. As far as we're on that. So if there are any questions, and if not, we can turn to tab 3 and take a look at the risk report. So the risk report is showing that our portfolio risk, as modeled by BARA, is a 9.2 versus our policy at 8.9, so showing that we're slightly riskier than policy by about 4% riskier. Part of that's due to the portfolio equity, so higher equity allocation dials that up, the left-hand dial. And then portfolio interest rate risk, what's the overall sensitivity of our plan to interest rates? And 1.8, very much in line with policy and the peer group. And then credit risk, how much credit risk do we have built in? That's also in line with our policy and slightly stronger than our peer group. This will change as we implement the FFP approach and start getting more of the short-term fixed income exposure into it. If you turn ahead to Exhibit 7, which is on page 4 of this report, I think these are the three really interesting charts to be thinking about from a risk perspective. And so chart 7 basically says, okay, if we take all of our asset class exposures and group them into these categories, equities, interest rates, credit, and inflation, where do we stand on it? We stand overweight on equities and underweight inflation as far as our asset class and our allocations go. But because equities are the most volatile portion of the portfolio, that is what's driving our portfolio volatility to be overweight 4%. So again, this is the 9.3 versus 8.9. That's, we're 4% overweight on portfolio risk. The next chart, Exhibit 8, says, okay, well, what if we took our asset class exposures and decomposed them into risk factors? And the idea there is that if you have credit exposure, it behaves somewhat like rates and it behaves somewhat like credit. And it has kind of an equity component in it too. And so if you decompose each of the asset classes and see where your risk is coming from, then you realize that we're pretty underweight credit because we haven't funded the private credit allocations yet. So that's going to continue to show. And we're actually overweight inflation because of the embedded inflation protection in our real estate portfolio and in our bond portfolio. So those two things are offsetting to a large extent. Again, we're overweight equity. And that helps us understand then our 4% allocation in terms of risk factors. And the bottom chart, Exhibit 9, is another way of looking at Exhibit 8, but saying, what if we took that 4.2% and broke it down into the components so that they sum to 4.2, so that we can see that our underweight to credit here partially offsets the overweight to equity exposure, then we have modest overweight in rates and inflation. So that's what's driving it. Now, ideally, I mean, if we could and if there were no transaction costs or anything else, we would manage the portfolio so that the total portfolio risk here, this top bar, would be zero. That our portfolio risk exactly matches our policy risk, because that's what we're trying to do, that's what we're trying to model. In actuality, we can't do that. We have to have our overweights and underweights. We're not going to manage it perfectly. But it gives you an idea of where our sensitivities are. So you look at these three charts and you say, where are our sensitivities? Equities. As the equity markets go, so go our portfolio. And so we need to be aware of that. Equities are the most volatile. And this picture will change a little bit as we implement FFP. But it gives you a different way of thinking about the risk exposures in the plan. And there are all sorts of other handy charts and things in there.
Item 8C, discussion and action regarding search for U.S. Treasury mandate. Is that correct?
Yes.
Ready to try this?
Absolutely.
Are when you get into the numbers, though, it gets really tiny.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's harder to read.
Yes.
So when we're looking at Rick's report, I wanted to think that'll work, but in case it didn't, I didn't want to go crash in the middle of his.
Okay, so can we jump back to page four, the executive summary? So this first point is that this is really driven by the FFP six-year asset allocation. We're talking about U.S. Treasuries, and U.S. Treasuries was assigned a 3% weighting in that allocation. So second bullet point, this book talks about the role in the portfolio, which we've covered previously, the ways we can get the exposure, and our recommendation. And so we'll conclude with a three-part recommendation. This is essentially what we'll be asking the board to approve. First, we're going to discuss and select the desired strategy. And then we want to authorize staff to negotiate and execute a contract with the selected investment manager. And then we're going to hold off on the funding of the strategy until we do the phase one rebalancing. So if you remember our implementation plan and how it steps through this whole realignment of the portfolio methodically, there are three phases where we're going to do the purposeful rebalancing. And this would be part of phase one, which would likely happen in March of next year. So that's our ask. So page six then just talks about the role in the portfolio, and it's those bottom three bullet points. It's about capital preservation, risk diversification, and liquidity. So treasuries tend to be the safest, the most liquid, and the flight to safety. So whenever everything else is acting irrationally, we expect our treasuries to hold down the fort. Page seven talks about some different options here. There's a couple different approaches. The top one is what we essentially modeled in our work is to just get pure U.S. Treasury exposure. Some managers also introduce other government-guaranteed bonds into that mix and say, yes, treasuries are safe, but there are also other things backed by the government. You could consider them as well, agencies, agency mortgage-backed securities. And then futures, none of the options we're talking about today use futures, but it is another way of synthetically getting exposure here. And then we can jump ahead to page eight, active versus passive. Active strategies, like what you're used to seeing, like having a Dodge and Cox or a PIMCO or someone like that, take a portfolio and manage it and think about decisions about where to buy to create the right duration, to create curve positioning, getting the other government secured securities in there. Or passive, just index this thing. Just get paid the lowest cost you can. Just get the U.S. Treasury exposure that we're seeking to get and call it done. Let's not overthink this. We're just trying to build some protection into the portfolio, and there's some really cheap alternatives there. So page nine gives us three active options: income and research, IRM, T. Rowe Price, and Vanguard. And each of these three are solid firms. You can see firm AUM, they're all big players. Their strategies go back a ways. Vanguard certainly to 91. T. Rowe is the newest here, 95. IRM is the newest from 2003. So even that's a 13-year track record. Out of these, Vanguard ends up being similar to an index, but different. IRM and T. Rowe are actively managed, but you'll see that strategy assets aren't real big here. $416 million and $455 million. We're talking about a $54 million allocation. We would be one-fifth of the fund then, basically. And that's probably not something I'd recommend doing. We'd like to see more assets here. Vanguard at $6.8 billion makes a little bit more sense as a real option. If we turn to page 10, passive options, we have Northern Trust and BlackRock. The Northern Trust are custodian, but this is actually part of the asset management space. They have two passively managed funds. One focuses on a 1 to 10 year intermediate time frame. One is more of a long-term government bond. So we're showing these two because to get our desired duration of 7 years, we'd have to combine these. We'd take both of them and we'd just allocate about 75% to the 1 to 10 year bond fund and 25% to the long-term bond fund. Similarly with BlackRock. Two funds, significant assets, similar duration and yield to maturity. So we have two competitors that are very much side by side there. So cutting to the chase, out of all of these options, we would recommend Northern Trust. From a passive-active perspective, we don't see that the active management adds the value to claim its fees, and we don't see the benefit of actually doing it. On the passive side, between Northern Trust and BlackRock, there's a bit of coin toss. Here, Northern Trust is coming in at 4.5 basis points, whereas BlackRock is coming in at 5 basis points. Northern Trust is your custodian. Not that that matters a whole lot, but we have a good relationship with them. So out of that, it seems like a very reasonable result. If anyone wanted to go BlackRock, I wouldn't have a big objection to it. I just think at the end of the day, you have to pick one. I'd probably go to Northern Trust.
I want to echo Ed's sentiments on passive versus active. I think this is a small mandate. I don't think you're going to earn a whole lot actively investing in the long run on this strategy. I looked at some of the manager's performance here in the exhibits or the book that you've shown us. None of them are very consistent in adding value above a benchmark. So I would definitely echo Ed's sentiments and choose to passively invest this. Regarding Northern Trust and BlackRock, I actually lean a little bit more towards BlackRock, and we haven't talked about this because I just really spent time late this morning looking into this. The only reason that I like BlackRock is because we have two passively invested funds from BlackRock right now. Now, I know that they're different. They are a large cap value and a large cap growth. But one of the things that BlackRock has always done month in and month out is that they are always able to return us the benchmark return less fees. Their return less fees has always been consistently above the benchmark return. I don't know how they do it. Kathy and I were talking about it today. They may be such big players in the market that they are the index, but nonetheless, they consistently beat the index after fees every single month. So if we allow ourselves to extrapolate and assume that they can do that in the fixed income market, then I would definitely want to go with BlackRock. But as Ed said, you know what? When it comes right down to it, it's probably not that big a deal. So I'm just trying to hang my hat on something between the two, and that's what I'm hanging my hat on.
Well, page 11 is only going to contradict you a little bit.
That's fine. That's what we're here for.
No. But it's it doesn't lead to a strong conclusion for or against BlackRock. All it does here is take a look at when we combine the two funds in the 75-25 ratio that we're looking at. It manages to underperform the benchmark consistently.
Well, it may be this asset class.
And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you do have trading costs and
absolutely
fixed income, and you have their 4.5 or 5 basis points management fee. So
I'm just going based on what I've seen from their management of our current lineup right now. That's all.
Can you speak to the securities lending and no securities lending? Because that definitely plays in, and I know that's a big part of why our custodial fees are low, is because we are involved in Northern Trust securities lending. That was part of the in the contract when we were negotiating it. What about here? Because you mentioned it, you listed here.
So with each of these options, we'd be investing in a fund on a separate account. And the funds are set up in two flavors, to have securities lending or no securities lending. When you do securities lending, it brings down the fees a little bit, so that 4.5 comes down to 3.5. So you save yourself a basis point. Same with BlackRock, goes from 5 to 4. So you save yourself a basis point. Securities lending is basically saying we're going to take the securities in our portfolio, lend them out so that others may short them, and we can buy them back. And in the process of doing that, when we lend them out, we get collateral back, and so our position is safe, because we get more collateral back than what they borrow. Yeah, so you get 102%, exactly. So it seems like a no-brainer. If we can do this and save ourselves a basis point, why wouldn't we? And the reason why we wouldn't is because of 2008, when these safest securities didn't work out. And then everyone had this come-to-Jesus moment, pardon the expression, but had this moment where they saw what happened in the markets, and these bonds that were safe weren't. and then they got themselves stuck in processes of trying to work out their securities lending agreements. And that became then the kind of vernacular of you're picking up nickels in front of a steamroller. It works great until it doesn't, and then you get steamrolled. So we would say for this, for U.S. Treasury mandate, where we're looking to really just have the safety of the plan here, don't bother. It's not worth the basis point. I mean, okay, if that's what we're trying to do, then we could probably get the basis point.
So I ask because since we do have a securities lending program with Northern Trust already, would we add into that or not?
Gotcha.
Leave this piece out, and I don't know if that's a decision we would want to make in addition to what the others would make.
Right. Right. So in this case, the securities lending would be with the fund, so allowing that fund to operate on a securities lending
so
basis.
So even if it was with Northern Trust, it's whoever's managing that fund.
Right.
So it would be almost a separate securities lending thing if we went in that direction.
Yes. Yeah.
So I will fire back at you and say you're right from the benchmark perspective, but they still seem to be, over the last 4 or 5 years, better than NT.
Yeah, so NT was better on the 1 year and
2010.
And that was it.
Yeah.
The 3, 5, 7, yep. 10 is all with
2007. Yeah, so, yeah. But you're right. Looks like historically on this asset class, they're not outperforming the benchmark. Yeah, this seems to me would be a tough asset class to beat the benchmark in. Consistently.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. Especially if you're going to charge a fee on top.
Exactly.
Of
all the more reason I think passive is probably the better choice here.
Yeah.
I can tell you that Northern Trust accountants are easier to work with than BlackRock's accountants. I mean, really, if it's not about the money, then if staff is having to, you know, interact with people, you should know that. State Street, which is who does BlackRock's stuff. It's not easy to work with.
That was a question I was going to ask. If on the passive, did either of them have the potential to create more work for office staff here? And if so, which preference would you have?
Dealing with BlackRock.
State Street.
I haven't worked with BlackRock before. Dan usually works with them. She does those reconciliations.
PIMCO works with State Street.
Yes,
which
trying
is,
to reconcile PIMCO and again was not an easy task at all.
Right, so we've dealt with State Street before, and so if it's 6 to 1, half a dozen the other, Northern Trust is easier to work with for staff. But just throw that out.
I don't think you're going to make a wrong decision here.
No,
let's just say that.
I agree.
At all.
Is the BlackRock exposure that we have today, though, is that a separate account? Because these would be funds. So I would think working with the fund would be really easy.
Yeah, I would think so.
Because you'd just be accounting for like one entry rather than the portfolio of securities.
Probably what we're doing now with BlackRock already. They're funds.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we can sit there and weed through what the right answer here is. Like I said, I don't think you can make a bad decision here.
I thought it was a coin toss. And that was,
yeah.
You're right, though. The performance numbers
a little better. Black Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Ed, you know, I think in the last meeting, Trustee expressed some concern, that maybe we've given too much control to, you know, the investment company to make this selection. Can you just maybe provide a high-level summary on how he came to the two real brief? I just wanted to make sure we, you know, address that concern.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and I'm sure the staff was engaged in getting down to the two, right? I'm sure that
well,
was the case, too.
In this case, there really aren't that many options out there.
Okay.
In fact, when we went out and looked at the universe through the databases, how many have pure treasury exposures, essentially none came back. So the three that we showed with IRNM, T. Rowe, and Vanguard, IRNM is the closest to a pure treasury position. And so as we were looking at that, we were saying, huh, that's odd, but okay, that's the way the market is. So there's nothing deep in research there. So we said, okay, what about passive indexes? BlackRock's the big player, and Northern Trust is our custodian. Let's take a look at them first. So BlackRock does have a product, two products, and we can combine them to get what we want, okay? Northern Trust was actually a migration where we were talking to them about, since you're the custodian, are you in an advantageous position to offer us something better? And they said, yeah, we can set up a brokerage account for you that you can get your treasury exposures for very cheap. I said, great, tell us more. So they walked us through it, and it turned out that there's no investment management agreement in place. It would rely on essentially Rick and company staff telling them what to buy, when to buy it, what to sell, when to sell. It's like, that's not what we want to do. That's not a good solution. So let's see what else you have. And they said, oh, we do have these index options. So, okay, great. Now we have something to compare to BlackRock as a major index provider.
So it's like the off-the-shelf
right.
type product, which you know doesn't have that level of sophistication that we need to you know, manage closely or what have you.
Right, right. It's one step away from selecting your cash management vehicle.
Sure.
Here's your cash management vehicle for this one. We'll take that one.
Thank you. I just wanted to be on record, you know, and
yep.
express that. So.
So I think we need a decision. Let me go to that last slide.
It's the same thing. 13 just happened.
There we go, right there. So we're looking for the strategy, active, passive, and given active or passive, which manager within that strategy would you like to go with? And we will negotiate the contract with who you tell us to. And will we balance the fund?
This is for $30 million.
This is for about $50, $55 million, something like that.
Does anybody feel that we need to be active? Is everybody okay going passive?
This kind of investment, I think. Passive's
fine.
Passive.
Yeah. I'm fine with that.
Passive, yeah.
And is that a motion we would need, Rick, to decide first
yes,
whether it be active or passive and then keep breaking it down?
We could do it in all in one fell
okay.
swoop.
So, Mr. Acting Chairman, in your absence, this end of the world thinks that passive is okay.
I figured that. I had a moment of clairvoyancy when I was out of the room, so okay. I figured that.
So I guess it comes down to then.
Northern.
Which are the two?
Right.
Right. So whatever the flavor is, if somebody wants to make a motion, either Northern Trust or BlackRock in the passive arena.
Is there a staff recommendation?
Yeah, like I said, I looked at the numbers and I like BlackRock because they were now slightly better than Northern Trust recently, and they've always added value above a benchmark after fees, not to say that they're going to in this case, but they have in our other two strategies. The argument for Northern Trust is that staff has worked well with Northern Trust in the past, and we would anticipate being able to continue that relationship. However, this strategy is very benign, and I think that that's why I'm not very passionate about this decision.
And I think we need to add into the minutes that whatever option we choose, it will be the option that does not include securities lending.
Correct. And in fact, it will include a weight of 75% to the intermediate fund, 25% to the longer duration fund to get the targeted duration for our portfolio.
We can have Kelly repeat all that back to us.
I think it's still fresh in our mind.
Yeah.
If it was up to me, notwithstanding the fact that this kind of part of the staff likes Northern Trust and this kind of like BlackRock. I really like Northern Trust when we visited them, and I think it's been a home run, the banking that they took over for us. And if it in any way strengthened our relationship to go this way, that will be worth it.
Totally.
Everything else looks to be kind of dead on.
Yeah. I agree with Jeff. I was very impressed with Northern Trust. They were very good to work with. And
I think that's an excellent reason to choose them.
That's my preference, too, Northern Trust.
So it looks like we're moving in the direction of Northern Trust. Would either one of you gentlemen like?
I think Michael has something for us.
Can we?
Yeah, I'll make a motion that.
Can we recommend the motion that you can just move staff's motion?
Sure.
Okay, so I would recommend that the motion be to invest in this Treasury mandate passively, to choose Northern Trust to manage the entire 54, let's say 3% mandate, mm-hmm. to allocate 75% to the intermediate term and 25% to the long-term strategy, authorize staff to negotiate and execute a contract with the selected investment manager, in this case Northern Trust, and coordinate funding the selected investment strategy with phase one in the rebalancing as outlined in the implementation plan.
So is that your motion?
Yes.
So motion by Trustee O'Neill.
Second.
Second by Sam Sharp. Is there any further discussion?
Nope.
Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Okay, we will now move on to item 9, Executive Director Administrative 9A, Legal and Legislation Update.
And this is Don Lee's agenda item?
Yeah, no report this month.
No report. All right, 9B, Information Technology Solution Project Update.
This is Kathy Hermans.
Contracts are definitely moving forward. We have about 16 schedules, and 9 of them are complete now, so we're on the positive side of this. We truly expect this to be finished up in the next week, so we will be kicking this project off in December.
Back in the light. Moving on to item 10, Committee Reports and Recommendation for Action, Standing Committees, 10A, Internal Governance Committee.
Okay, the Internal Governance Committee met on the 15th of November, and the Brown Armstrong, the financial auditor, was there to present their reports. The comprehensive annual report was presented as well. There were no significant findings in the financial reports for what, the third year in a row now. Natalie has done an excellent job. She's very thorough in keeping our books in order. So the committee adopted the report as it was presented. And then we moved on to some new and some amended policies. As part of the investment statement policy that we're working on, we realized we didn't actually have a form for placement agency disclosure for people to fill out, for the different managers to fill out. So I went back through the law, made sure our policy was up to date, got a form put together, and so we brought a form to the committee. There was some changes and edits to the mass media policy. We updated the stale dated checks and unclaimed benefits policy, and that one was mostly due to just technology. We were doing it differently, and we needed to update the policy to actually match what we were doing. And we also needed a records retention policy before we could get rolling into imaging member records. So all four of those were presented to the Internal Governance Committee. They went through them thoroughly and gave us a few changes. Those changes were then updated, and this is what we're bringing them to you. The committee did adopt all the policies with the changes they recommended. So what I need from you is you're okay with that to accept the policy. If you have any questions, let me know.
Sam, you're on that committee, correct?
Yes.
Do you have anything to add?
The one primary one on the CAFR was that all prior findings were cleared, and that was really big, and they weren't under report. As we went through the other policies, some of the language was outdated. I know we're pushing towards a process of having policies, directives, and procedures, and a little bit of what we did was separate that. And then there were just a few numbering errors from Kathy's hard work late at night. So we corrected that too, so thank you for that. Aside from that, the changes were consistent with just updating, because some of them were from 2008, so they did need some change. The mass media policy, some of the things that were addressed had to do with new federal statutes that needed to be addressed. So other than that, nothing major to the to report on any of the other policies.
Okay. On the placement agency policy, what are the major, if anything added or like major change, significant change?
No, basically our policy was built exactly against the law itself, the code section, but it was not in the same order as the form I was trying to put together. So
okay.
I actually kind of rearranged it a little bit and made the numbering match the form and vice versa. So it was something staff could work with. Now, once adopted, this form, the policy and the form will be sent to all of our managers, as well as any new managers we may be taking on. Actually, they can even be people even just coming to see us. Some of them have to fill these forms out. And the law requires this information. We just didn't have a formal way of gathering the information. So that's why the policy looks like there were quite a few changes, but it was more moving things around and formatting.
Again, for the benefit of a trustee who might have expressed concerns, I just wanted to be clear that we haven't relaxed it in any which way.
No, we have not relaxed anything at all. When it was initially adopted, the policy was sent out to all managers, and all they had to do was respond to an email. And so this is a more formal process, which most of the systems are using.
Okay.
So we're just kind of conforming to the
Thank you.
More formal.
Okay, so just for clarification, the staff recommendation, what we'll be voting on is to accept the Internal Governance Committee's recommendation to approve the following: the June 30, 2016 and 2015 CAFR and independent auditor reports, placement agent policy, mass media policy, stale dated checks and unclaimed benefits policy, and the records retention policy. Does anybody want to make a motion in regards to those items in that motion?
A motion that we accept them as they've been presented to us.
Second. Okay, motion by Sam Sharp, seconded by Jeff Grover. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. We'll now move on to item 10B, Strategic Planning Committee. 10BI, discussion and action regarding the Strategic Planning Committee's recommendation to approve the 2017 through 2019 strategic plan.
In March of 2016, the Board of Retirement approved staff recommendation at that time to retain the four high-level strategic objectives that the Board actually had a hand in crafting in 2013. If you remember, we all met out at Oakdale. It's been over 3 years now, and we had the gentleman from Cortex, Tommy Annucci, and we, with your input, we crafted four very high-level strategic objectives. So in March, the board decided, instead of going through that whole process again, that they felt that the four strategic objectives that we had agreed to and that we had used the last 3 years were still valid today. And you agreed to send us back and craft out now a more refinement of those objectives into strategies. And then we were to present those to the Strategic Planning Committee, which we did last week. And they agreed to staff's recommendations for the strategies going forward that actually meet those high-level strategic objectives that you agreed to. Those, I can just really fast read you what we focused on this year pertaining to those high-level strategic objectives. The strategies this year are to monitor, which is spelled incorrectly. Way to go, Rick. Monitor and maintaining awareness of portfolio risk and identifying market opportunities that may allow StanSera to meaningfully de-risk its portfolio. Incorporate financial principles that create efficiencies in the cash flow process. Developing the ability to understand and monitor investment manager thesis and use this information regarding manager disposition. Continue to develop StanSera staff to play a greater role in the investment governance process. Professional development of StanSera staff, successful implementation of the pension administration project, the creation of efficiencies in our overall administrative process, and succession planning. those are the areas that we focused on in developing the strategies necessary to meet the high-level objectives that you folks set in 2013. So we're asking for your approval of the final strategic plan, and then just to give you a little more background, after you approve this, then staff will go back and we will refine this even more in terms of tasks that we would use to meet these strategies and how we would judge whether we're doing what we said we were going to do. And we would incorporate these into our goals and our reports every quarter to you. So given those strategies that the strategic plan planning committee agreed to, their recommendation is to accept the strategic plan for 2017-2019 as presented here today.
So that's what we'll be voting on?
Correct.
Would anyone like to make a motion?
Motion.
Motion by Mandeep. Second by Trustee DeMartini. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Okay, we'll now move on to item 11, which is closed session. We do have one item in closed session, which is 11B.
Two items,
excuse me. So that would be 11B that I know of and
C.
And 11C. Okay.
Yep, B and C.
So,
scram.
Is there a motion to go into closed session?
So moved.
So moved by Trustee Grover. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Trustee O'Neill. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? We are now moving into closed session.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Hey.
Okay. Have a good day.
Safe trip.
We're now back in open session. Okay, in regards to closed session items, the board took under consideration item 11B, and there's nothing to report out on that item. With respect to item 11C, discussion action regarding the executive director's annual review of public employment under government code section 54954.5, the board took into consideration the review committee's report and recommendations in regards to the executive director's annual performance. A motion was made by Trustee Michael O'Neill and seconded by Jeff Grover to adopt the review committee's recommendation and increase in the executive director's salary. The motion was carried unanimously, and what was approved was a 5% increase to the executive director's annual salary, which on an hourly breakdown currently at $84.33, increased now to $88.55. On an annual basis, current salary $175,406.40 to now include an increase to $184,184. Even.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is that all you need, Madam Secretary?
Okay, but we need to have a motion in open session approving the salary increase.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because that's, I thought that's what I was trying to explain to you before I left here, is that you can discuss the basis for the salary increase in closed session, and you can agree on this, on the salary increase and what it's going to be and why it should be what it is, but the actual expenditure of funds has to be done in open session. So I think we need to have a motion basically approving the salary increase in open session.
So is there a motion?
I'll make that motion. I'll make a motion that we accept the committee's report and that we increase the director's salary from an hourly rate of $84.33 to $88.55, which is an annualized increase from $175,406.40 to $184,184.
So motion by Trustee O'Neill, seconded by Jeff Grover. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Okay. We will now move on to members' forum.
Fred?
Nothing for me.
Yeah. I'd like to see the board packet come out on Friday rather than Monday. It's
Yeah, I got mine a little late as well, so.
I got mine Monday afternoon.
That's when I got mine.
I have meetings a lot of times in the evenings, and it's difficult to get through it all.
So we're going to make an attempt, we just talked about this last week, to try to get these out on Thursday from now on. I can tell you what?
I'm okay with Friday, but not on Monday.
Oh.
Well, it's after hours on Friday, so.
We can always deliver your packet to you.
Until Monday unless, yeah, we can drive out to your place.
Well, if you just get it done sooner, you wouldn't have to deliver.
Well, we do. And we were going to get it done on Thursday this week, but I'm telling you, there were several things that came up that prevented us from doing this. We didn't get some of the presentations in time.
Well, I realize stuff can happen, but just, you know, if you can try and get it on Friday, it's better.
Just say, okay, we'll try.
We will. We've already talked about it.
Wow.
Jim was just saying it would be more convenient.
Yeah.
Essentially, we only meet once a month. So our packets are big. There's a lot of stuff to go through. The stuff's important. It's not real easy to understand. I'd like to have the weekend to do it if possible.
If we ever can't make the Thursday, we will contact you on Friday and find out how to get it to you by either Friday the night when it's done or the Saturday morning. We'll find out what your pleasure is.
I'm there every day.
We can totally do that, though.
Okay.
Give me a chance to go out to your place anyway.
Check out the cars, huh?
I apologize for missing my committee meeting. I had it on my calendar, but I didn't put down that it was the planning meeting. And I thought I just put in Stan Sarah, and I thought I'd just put my Stan Sarah meeting on the wrong day, and because of the holiday I didn't get my packet until the day of the meeting, so I apologize. Won't happen again.
Mandated training the 5th through the 16th of December will not be at the next meeting.
Nothing to report on a professional level, but life has changed a little bit for me. Now I work for the Behavioral Health and Recovery Services rather than the Chief Executive Office.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Dawn?
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes.
I do have a reminder that the meeting is December 13th, so that brings us back here shorter than a month, so we will try to get that packet ready on time.
Have you published the schedule for next year yet?
That's what I was just going to say. We'll be bringing the schedule for next year, since this is members forum, unless you want us to bring back up the meeting dates and time, we'll keep them the same as what we have now. If not, we can bring an agenda item in December to discuss the dates if you need a change.
And you're just asking to know what they are, right? Not to change.
Yeah, you guys are the last ones of everybody to come out with next year's schedule, especially if you plan on doing it the same. Because I have the calendar from every committee I have already in, except for you guys.
Well, we can take that and make sure and do it earlier next year. We can move it and do it earlier.
And it's
next
kind of
year.
Important because other stuff.
Sure,
you know,
absolutely.
If I look in there and I see that I've got a meeting, I won't schedule something if it's not there.
Then we will keep it the same, and it will be approved in December, and next year we'll do it earlier.
Some of our processes and procedures are just legacy procedures from the past, and we have just carried them on, but we can totally change things around.
Well, somebody has to be last with the schedule, so
it's important.
You guys have always been there.
The only other thing I want to say is that we're going to be bringing the Stan Sarah committee assignments in the December meeting as well, instead of later in January. So if you could please let me know before the agenda packet, so it would be the week prior to the 13th, if you have a desire to sit on a committee, we would need to know that as soon as possible. That's all I have.
Rick?
I have nothing.
Kathy?
Hey, the Board of Supervisors today approved closing operations for non-essential departments for December 23rd. Typically, if Christmas falls on a Sunday, Christmas Eve, you don't get your half day of Christmas Eve off, and the Board of Supervisors approved giving it to all non-essential personnel. So Friday, they are closing county offices. If you would like us to agendize that and bring it to the meeting in December, because this board has the authority over whether or not we're open or not, I can, you know, bring it, put it on the agenda for the next meeting, or because we're county employees, we follow the Board of Supervisors on county employee stuff. It's a very interesting relationship we have, having county employees with a board that's separate. It always adds that question, who says yes to what.
I don't need to see that.
That's Rick's problem.
Within Rick's purview.
Okay, right. Thank you very much.
Real quick, first of all, condolences to Deputy Dennis Wallace's family. Tragic loss. I want to thank staff for processing his benefits so quickly. I know the family appreciates it. And then last but not least, Donna Riley sent me an email, if you can put on the December agenda. She wants a discussion about media training with the county PIO, David Jones, if the board is interested. So just as a discussion item to see if there's any interest by the board, and that's all I have. Anything else for the good of the order? Seeing none, happy Thanksgiving to everyone. Meeting is adjourned.